Hi, everyone. Welcome to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. I'm Langdon DeMint.
And I'm Julian Taylor.
And welcome to our podcast. Welcome, everyone, to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. I'm Langdon DeMint, here with my dear British bald friend and a bald guest today. Jules, how are you, buddy?
I am good. There were signs of spring and golf in the air in the UK. We kind of reverted a bit back to type, but I'm all good on this side of the pond. And I'm glad to see you've brought a guest in who's got the correct hairstyle for this particular podcast as well.
Is it going to become only bald guys talking safety?
You know, we have tried to get people to shave their head, and thus far it's been to no avail. So to finally have another true, you know, baldy. It's good. These are choices that we didn't get to make. Yep. They just were thrust upon us.
We have suggested bald caps as well, haven't we? Maybe we get those as some merch that we can hand out when we go and do some live events. Some
bald caps.
I'll see those at ASSP. That'll be a big. You can sign them even and start sending handing them out. Yeah.
Like lots of people walking around in bald caps. You know where they've come from.
Yeah, that would be good. And then we could make initials to like put on top of the bald cap.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like a bald tattoo.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a strong work.
We've signed people's heads.
Yeah, exactly. But no, we do appreciate joining for all those that are listening. We have a guest today, and that is Ryan Costello. He is with Sela Services. And I've been fortunate to meet Ryan and work with him in, I guess, a number of little ways far more recently. But it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast and look forward to especially some of the discussions that I know you and I've had. And then you, Jules, and myself, it's really exciting to hear about how things have transitioned. So if you would like to give us a backstory and feel free to dive in as much as you want.
All right. Thanks, Landon. So I'm Ryan Costello. I've been with Sela Services now for about a year and a half. I've been in the safety world for more than 20 years. And like every time those words come out of my mouth, I'm still like a little shocked. You know, it's like one of those things, like all of a sudden it's 20 plus years and trying to figure that out. But
well, you started when you were 15. That's okay.
It's like everybody else. I never expected to be in safety. My academic background is in anthropology, focusing on black and gray market economics in post-Soviet Russia. So that is about as far from safety as you can possibly be. And I found myself graduating from college and realizing that I needed to eat. And grad school didn't work out for me. So ended up in the safety world. I started my career in manufacturing. I was with American Express doing kind of a lot of construction work, design and construction, and some of those bigger regional corporate safety things. And then since then I've spent my time in warehousing and distribution and more manufacturing. And now with Sela, we are a home services company. So we provide HVAC, electrical, plumbing, drain cleaning, you know, basically anything that you need to fix up your home. Well, you know, we provide, and we're a extraordinarily rapidly growing company. Like since we spoke last, I think we've added two companies to our portfolio. So it's been a pace that is shockingly rapid at times, but it's been a fantastic journey so far. We have about 1,200 people working in the field every day, coming in to an office maybe once a week, which has been a pretty big transition versus sitting there in like a warehousing where everybody's there every day, manufacturing, same sort of thing. So it's been definitely a different journey from here, but it's been very nice to work for a company that sees safety as a competitive advantage and wants to really push the limit and become kind of an employer of choice in that through safety, which is just when looking for a job, having those conversations with some of our executives, it was like, you know, it's almost like a warm hug compared to some of the other companies I've worked for. Where it's like, wait, you see this as a value add, as something competitive, like, and you want to invest in it? Like, okay, let's go, let's do this and see what we can accomplish.
The only thing I was going to say, Ryan, is it's that classic judgment to call, is do they really mean it or are they just saying it? Because we hear it loads, don't we? Yeah.
Yes. And I've definitely been at places before where it's, you know, we are 100% committed to safety. And then it's like, when you get there, it's like, well,
yeah.
You know, we're committed to it, but we're not going to spend any money on it. Or we're not going to provide time for it. And it's very different to be at a place where they actually put their money where their mouth is and put the time where their mouth is.
Yeah. We're committed to it, but not this week because we're really busy doing other stuff this week.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, no, or the whole, you know, we're very committed. It's our number one priority. Our numbers are low. We have to get it going a little more and make sure we're hitting these numbers. You know, that's the...
Yeah.
And then when you brought up a good point, then when you get how do we get the actual, you know, additional budget to make changes? You know, our processes are fine. There should be, you know, that's the ones to me that always make the biggest noticeable impact, is when if you're not allowed to do anything or you have to always kind of paint that picture, that's when you start seeing, you know, maybe it's not really the focus it once was.
Or when you have a company that describes itself as heavily matrixed and it becomes a way of like shooting down projects before they're born, really, you know, like it becomes a real challenge to try and get anything done. And it's not even necessarily, you know, it's okay to have a lot of people to approve something in a very collaborative environment. But when it becomes a way of canceling things before they can even really have like, really germinate the ideas, it becomes a real challenge to get anything done in those kinds of environments.
I'm going to kind of sort of pick up on that point, Ryan, because it's we talk to hundreds of organizations, and sort of over the sort of time I've been involved with sort of this organization, we talk to so many different organizations, and you're going and talking about major change projects, and if it was in any other part of the organization, you would see lots of people there because they want to hear about what it is that you're talking about and sort of get involved with sort of moving that project forward. And so often we would rock up and there'd be one person or two people sitting there and you say, so what's leadership's view on this? And you would see the shoulders slump and it just felt like with so many companies that you talk to, it was a battle to get things done. So these are the same people who are saying, yeah, safety is our number one priority, but it's a battle to then go and get any kind of investment into safety projects or safety change. Yep.
Yeah. I feel like in my career, I learned to fight like guerrilla wars against those kinds of things, like just sitting there like a partisan and just being all right, nothing's a major project, but we're going to tweak this thing. We're just going to do it. We're not going to ask permission. We're just going to make this change and see if anyone notices.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it'll happen. One of two things will happen. It'll either be really successful and people will want to get involved in, or it'll bomb out and we can just kind of quietly hide the fact that it completely did not work and we learned something from it, hopefully.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious to, I guess, kind of before we keep diving into that. So with what you're doing now, what got you into safety? And mainly because thinking about that transition to where you are now with people out on the floor out in the environment away, that's drastically different from the manufacturing, from the warehousing. And that's a lot tougher. That's what I'm actually ultimately going to get to, which you and I've talked a lot about. But what led you to health and safety from anthropology? I mean, they're very similar. So I'm curious to...
I wish it was a more interesting story, but it was literally like, I am desperate for a job. I graduated, you know, finished my thesis, all that kind of stuff. I was teaching a web design class, just like a summer class, literally like couldn't afford to eat kind of like level. It was like a real shocking summer of poverty, shall we say. And they ended up getting an internship in safety with a commercial print company. And again, just like it was minimum wage, basically, from what I remember. You know, it was pretty raw. During college, I did have an internship with a company that makes window shades. And they were VP. I was helping with the VPP application, everything else, and I really enjoyed it. That was just local to where I had been living. And had a fantastic team there, an excellent mentor. And, you know, after graduating, I got into grad school. I was intending on being an academic full on. That was my plan, was just to stay in the academic world, but I didn't get funding at grad school. And I was looking at all of my student debt at that point. I was like, I can't double this and then make $30,000 a year teaching. Like, it's not possible. It wasn't going to happen. So, I just kept up with it. And then, you know, my original plan was I'll do this for a year and then I'll apply again and see what happens. And then 1 year turns into 3 years, and 3 years is 5 years, you know, and you start getting into it more and really enjoying it. And I think that's probably a pretty common story among a lot of safety people, is, you know, it can be really brutal work. You know, when I started, I was in a job, I was traveling roughly 3 weeks on, and then I would be home for a week. I was home, technically homeless, for 2 years. I was just traveling from place to place, and I'd go crash with friends just to go see. It was literally a very nomadic lifestyle. And, you know, I kind of realized afterwards that I went a little feral after that, like, you know, just having long periods of not interacting with people in like a social way was a little intense mentally. go ahead, Julian.
No, I was going to say, you're drawing a really great picture here of yourself, Ryan, which is guerrilla warfare, feral. Yes. I'm just imagining people at Sela going, what's that crazy safety guy right, doing with his face blacked out and camo on today? Yeah,
poor Ryan was in the corner eating lunch. Just
But, you know, that happens so much to like younger safety people. It's something I still think about a lot today when I interact with people who are just getting into it, you know, and like, how do you advocate for yourself to not just have like just the worst job? Like, I don't know how people, I don't know how I stuck with it through those first 2 years sometimes, you know. It was pretty wild when I look back at it, what the lifestyle was like. Some people love it. You know, I know people who love traveling all day, every day, and that's what they want to do. But, you know, to me, there was an upper limit of what was really mentally possible, and I think I kind of hit it there. But you know, moving to Amex was like a very good experience for me, and I was there for a very long time. And you know, that's the kind of environment that when I work with younger people now, in the kind of not necessarily in a full mentorship, but just working with people who are coming up, it's like, if you find the place that works for you and clicks for you, and it can be a really, really rewarding profession, and, you know, you can do some great things. But if you get stuck in a bad situation, and not that that was a terrible situation, it paid my bills, but it was, you know, I think the profession has a tendency to kind of chew up and spit out younger people or new, not so younger, but new in career people. You know, there's a lot of like low man on the totem pole kind of stuff that happens. It's really challenging.
Well, you know, and I think to that, health and safety. So, you know, I got my master's, occupational health, safety, industrial hygiene, and you learn the basics really well. I mean, they, you know, Murray State, fantastic program where I went, taught what you needed, excellent. But when you get out and you realize how much more there is to it, meaning the people side of it, you know, establishing, here you go, Jules, establishing camaraderie with everyone. So you're not just like, so you're not the safety cop, right? Because that's, I mean, that's a struggle. And then you realize people do things differently when you walk up. And how do you make sure that instead of, oh crap, here comes Langdon, you know, it's the, hey, what's, you know, the really establishing that communication, that openness, like, I'm not trying to slap you on the hand. I just want to make sure you're doing things right. If you see me doing something wrong, if I'm not paying attention, I'm walking outside the line, or I'm, you know, cutting wood and don't have safety. I mean, call, you know, it's not a bad thing. Say, hey, wear your glasses, big guy, you know, whatever. It's, I think to me, that's a lot of the aspect that's not taught. And then you look at how do you make the business case to sell safety internally within those are two aspects that we just kind of assume, oh, everybody wants to be safe. Well, they do, but that doesn't mean they want to put anything to it.
Mm-hmm. And then you leave that kind of situation and you're learning to be a leader in a very specific environment. And you're mirroring leadership behaviors that are successful there. And depending on where you're at, that could be a great thing or it could be, you know, not a great thing. So there's a certain element of like education and de-education that happens those first 5 years where you're figuring out, you know, what do you want to be? How do you want to do it? And what kind of place is the right fit? And that's hard. That's, I think, a very hard experience. You know, if you're not in a great place to begin with, and it's really about, you have to figure out what you're going to take from what positive things you're going to take from those kinds of experiences and figure it out. And I think the people who don't leave the profession and the people who do end up, it seems like being lifers. I don't think I've met somebody who is like, I did safety for 4 years and started doing something else. Or coming in really late and they're like, yeah, I think I'll do this for 6 months. You know, it's just not, you see that with like management consulting and some of those kinds of folks. I'm going to do this for a while and then this is my plan. You don't see that with safety for some reason.
I think it's interesting. I've got a friend who says, if it doesn't kill you, it's good for you. I think it's not a bad approach in life in that even the tough things we go through, we can grow and learn from them. But I think it can be quite dispiriting being a safety person within a business that isn't really committed to it, because you just don't get any support, any help, any guidance from it. But equally, you can learn from it and move on. So what are some of the tips you would sort of give to younger members of the profession then, Ryan, in terms of some of the maybe do's and don'ts around trying to get that buy-in from the organization?
You know, when I've had some of those conversations with people, the one thing that's crazy now is the job market is so much better than it was for safety. Companies recognize the need for it, are willing to hire people. So don't stick around in a bad situation just because you're worried about what it's going to look like on a resume if you leave, you know, and you have to advocate for yourself. And, you know, not that you shouldn't kind of learn from a difficult situation, because I think that's really important as well. But I've definitely known people who are in situations that are really not good and don't explore because they're worried about what it's going to look like. And I think if you start from a place of understanding what you bring to the table and where you want to be at a certain point, that's very helpful. And then otherwise, I think it being involved in kind of the like local professional associations, whatever, just so you can have camaraderie with other people and get advice and network and understand, you know, is the grass greener or is it not? Like, what is my situation? What context am I actually sitting in? You know, and then I think that really can help people quite a bit. You know, a lot of times when I'm hiring someone, even if it's for a safety role, I'm not necessarily even hiring someone with like a safety degree or anything like that. I love pulling people who maybe were on safety committees for a long time, show a lot of commitment and interest, and that becomes part of their kind of professional development, because they have such a great like rapport and understanding of, you know, what are the people who work there going through. They come from such a position of empathy that it's really not that having a traditional safety background is bad or anything like that. You know, I've definitely worked with people from both kind of areas, but I think it could be really powerful when you have someone who says, yeah, you know, I've done that job. I know how much it sucks and when it sucks. And you know, my job is to help try and keep you safe and how, you know, we can work with doing that together.
I really like that, Ryan. I love that kind of empathy piece. It's the danger, I think you kind of alluded to this earlier, which is as a younger person, you might feel that because we're talking about compliance, actually you can sort of use the need to be compliant and follow regs as a reason to tell people to do stuff. But actually it's not a compelling thing for people to actually want to do it, is it? So I think that empathy piece is so important. And again, you only learn that by making the screw ups and probably getting it wrong a few times. But it's learning what's the best approach here to embrace people, get people to embrace safety, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, how do you foster those relationships with people? And it's hard when you're new and you're younger, especially if you're in a company where there's people who are very experienced in it. You know, that there's hurdles to that, and recognizing that and being comfortable that those hurdles exist, and an understanding that you know, like when I first started getting into warehousing distribution, I was in the grocery distribution industry, and you know, these were Teamsters shops in New Jersey, like hardcore union people there for people either kind of washed out very quickly or were there forever. And you had to kind of go in and say, like, look, I don't know this business. You know, I know safety. You're going to have to teach me and, you know, kind of show the respect for the people who had been there a long time and try and work with them just in understanding that, like, hey, I'm a person and I'm going to treat you like a person. And then we'll go from there. I want you to be as safe as possible. And if there's issues, we're going to talk about it. You know, I'm not going to call you out in front of other people just as a sign of respect. You know, those kinds of things that, you know, you have to learn to navigate that a bit. And I think being open about your own blind spots, you know, like coming into my role now, I have more of a commercial construction like background, you know, like working with high rise buildings, big buildings, you know, we're in people's homes every day now. And it's completely like, it's incredibly dynamic. You know, it's not a business that I knew anything about going into it and coming into this and saying, hey, you know, I know safety. I am theoretically, at least I'm an expert on safety. there's letters after my name that people think means that, but I'm not going to pretend that I know how to do your job. So, you know, teach me about this. What, you know, what do I need to know? What are your challenges? How, you know, what is really tough about your day? You know, where are you getting support from safety? Where are you not getting supported in safety? And how do we start building that at that base ground level? Because our workforce is, we're not in building, you know, we're not in offices, anything like that. We're in homes every day.
I think to that, what is, just because that environment, and you just painted the picture very well from where you've been to now with people being in homes, all the other environmental factors that can come with that outside of the typical, what's some of the biggest challenges you see around health and safety, getting the employees who are masters of the job, getting them to think a little more aware than, because right, it's easy to, I mean, I work from home. It's easy to, and I always joke, I have actually a cord right here and I can't cut a hole in my rug, I've been told. So, you know, it's a different environment, right?
Yeah.
So what are some of the biggest challenges you see with that transition of workers and trying to help them understand the importance constantly and that perspective?
You know, one of the things that drew me to this company right from the get-go, you know, when I was first interviewing for the position was, I forget exactly who I was interviewing with at the time, you know, one of our senior folks, they said that basically that everyone here, you know, and working in the trades, like they want to go home, they want to be safe, you know, that the majority of the work we do is done safely. But what we need to do is make sure that they have kind of the tools they need and the what they need to get to accomplish that. You know, we're in places like even just from my own home. So this, I actually, before I worked here, we used them to do HVAC work in our house. They were recommended to us. It was very weird, but the guy comes into our house. We have this attic that the previous owners had blown probably 2 feet of like loose cellulose insulation into. And we needed some attic AC work. And the guy comes in and I'm just like, I'm really sorry. This is going to suck. Like, you're like, good luck finding floor joists. I don't know if there's flooring, anything like that. So, you know, when we came here, I had that moment where I was like, they deal with this several times a day. We are going into an environment that maybe the house is a little bit hoardy, or you're in a basement or a crawl space where junk is just piled everywhere. You know, it's in general, you know, we're working in spaces that are not occupied all the time. So they're not going to be, it's not like, I remember sometimes going to, like, say, like a switchgear room in a big, like, those places are always immaculate. Nothing's there. That floor is like the most beautiful epoxy you've ever seen, or should, most times, I'm sure that that's not always true, but like, compare that to like most people's basements where they've got like all the Christmas decorations piled up around their furnace. So how do we put people in a position where, first of all, they have the knowledge to recognize those hazards? And I think generally people in this business, you kind of, if you don't know it, anything going in 6 months, you're going to hurt yourself enough in those, that the beginning, hopefully not severely, you're going to learn where the hazards are pretty quickly. But then how do we give them the tools to mitigate those hazards, the equipment to mitigate those hazards, even just something as simple as like, do you have plywood in your truck? And so that you can build a floor in an attic if you need to real quick. And those were the kinds of things that we got back from the field. It was just, what are you doing every day to make your job a little easier? And having those conversations and figuring out where some of those blind spots were. Like, one of the big things coming in was gloves, because people would get kind of like gloves from Home Depot or whatever, and then they'd be told they had to wear the gloves all day at work. And it's just, if you're trying to handle like a teeny little set screw on something, like, forget about it. Those gloves aren't good. Like, you're not going to feel anything. So, getting feedback from folks, trying things out, and say, finally landing on a glove that, look, it's not going to protect you from super sharp sheet metal, but it's going to provide protection across the board in most situations that our people are in. And those are the kinds of things that, how do we provide those kinds of things to our people and do it consistently and do it well? And that's probably really, for me, at least, that was where the start was. It's just trying to understand where are people's challenges and how can we fix them?
I think you hit something that's very pertinent. I'm curious about from like a training and getting everyone aware to, we talk, start when safe, kind of that principle, when it's there, they have to do the job. But how does that, what does that look like as far as getting everyone ready to do the job, understanding it? Is there trainings that, how have you kind of worked around that perspective?
I think one of the big advantages of working in the trades is apprenticeship. And that's not something you see in a lot of other industries anymore. So you have people who are coming in and are learning from someone else from the beginning. Maybe they've done trade school. They've got a base knowledge. So now they're in, I think of places I've worked where, like, we had, let's say, a week of training in a bunch of different positions. And you don't know not anything about anything at that point. But there's such like a good history of apprenticeship in the trades that you still get that kind of idea coming in. So that people are getting their feet wet as essentially a helper. They're just moving stuff around. They're getting tools from the truck. They're coming back and forth, but it gives you that kind of context. So you're working with an expert or someone who at least has significantly more knowledge. Our company has a very strong commitment to continued education in terms of, again, pure skills training. We're doing training like at our buildings. There's like a training center, like essentially a live fire training. There's like a furnace you're going to work on in a controlled environment, so we can teach them the safety aspects of that in an environment that we can control. And it's not highly dynamic like you're going to find in the field, but at least we're working from a base set of knowledge that says, hey, you're going to shut the gas off this way. You're going to turn the electric off this way. And it's going to be applicable to the field. Now you start getting in your more apprenticeship side, you're going to see how that those building blocks you have, now you can build on it more and apply it in a very dynamic way. And we try and do the same with safety, whereas like I try and focus on things like, what is the hazard we're going to look at here? What are, when we look at, say, I'm not going to tell someone how to disconnect an AC compressor, but I'm going to tell you you need to look for a disconnect, and how do you test for electricity that's still there? You know, because we work with a lot of capacitors and things like that. You know, how are you going to make sure that this piece of equipment is actually fully turned off, and why is that important? And then you have knowledge that you can broadly apply to how do I disconnect these 10 other kinds of things that I have to work with every day.
One thing that sort of struck me that you said earlier, Ryan, and I think is really important, you talked about the set screw and the gloves. And,
yeah.
and it's even little things like that, isn't it? That if you become too inflexible about you've got to wear this type of glove to do this type of job, that's what gets people's backs up around safety. And I think one of the important things you talked about was that, and I love it, that vulnerability to say, look, you're the experts in your job, but tell me about it so we can identify what is the best way to do this job safely.
And when we approach like operational learning, I think if you tell someone, no, you're wrong because it isn't protective enough, you just show that you didn't learn anything. Like, so you have to have enough authenticity to say, okay, this makes sense. I understand that, look, there is a chance we're going to have cuts from internally very sharp pieces of equipment, but I have a glove now that someone is going to be able to wear all day, every day. So I'd rather protect that 80% of normal work and worry a little bit less about the sheet metal exposure and things like that. And we give, you know, we have other types of equipment for when you're handling that, but I'd much rather do that than give someone a cut level 6 glove that they can't wear during their day. And I've protected them against this more severe hazard, but I've exposed them to their normal everyday hazard. And I think that's where sometimes people get kind of caught up in safety. And even when you try and do operational learning, if you're going to tell someone no, you've kind of shut that down. And if you're going to say no, you better have a really good reason about or why, and beyond just kind of saying that it's, well, that's not safe enough. Because doing safety harder, or we're going to more safety you, it's, I don't know. I just don't think that that's been a very effective tool for a lot of people. And even when you approach learning like that, you've got to be more flexible from a safety perspective about understanding what the actual hazards are and what the actual job is like day in and day out.
I remember, I think we talked about this when we caught up before, and I was walking around a packaging plant in Auckland in New Zealand, of all places, with a great lady called Rachel. And we're walking around, and she's just showing me around the plant because I was there on a visit. And there's a guy operating a machine, and it had a touch sensitive screen to do the operations. And he's there, and it was almost like fingerless gloves. He got all the ends of his gloves cut off. And again, it's how do you deal with that? And she was just fantastic. And she just went up and said, do you mind me asking why you've done that to your gloves? And he said, yeah, really simple. I can't operate the machine right. With my gloves on. But it was great because she said, right, okay, let's go away and find you some gloves that have got the fingers that you can operate the touchscreen with. And he was like, great. And we walked around the corner, and then there's a guy there, and he's got his safety specs up on his head. And the same thing again. Do you mind me asking why you've got your specs up on your head? Instead of going in with the iron fist of put your specs down, and similar kind of thing. It's a hot, humid atmosphere. And he said, yeah, I put my glasses down. I can't see anything because they just steam up. Okay, let's go and get you some better glasses. And again, that kind of coaching approach is fantastic to see in action, because it just buys that or builds that camaraderie that you're talking about. They say, I've used your word, Langdon. Yeah. But it builds that camaraderie, doesn't it? And people will, again, next time they see you walking around the plant, it's not the safety police coming, it's the person who helped me, which is really different. Yeah.
One of my favorite examples of that, especially with the glasses, was, you know, there was a glasses standard, you know, PPE glasses standard, yeah. But the workforce started aging.
Yeah.
The glasses worked for a really long time. Now people started needing progressives, and yeah. like or reader safety glasses. You have to expand your offering sometimes yeah. as things yeah. change over time, and it's not just yeah. because you've got a newer, better product, but like we had fantastically skilled operators, people who had been there for 30 years, and the stuff that yeah. worked for them 5 years ago, it doesn't work for them anymore. You know, like I know for myself, all of a sudden I'm in progressives over the past 2 years, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? And you have people kind of in that same boat, and rather than people necessarily volunteering that, you see them maybe like, is that exactly the example you gave where they're up on their head and it's like, well, or the touchscreen interface they're using is, you know, it's, the text is small. Maybe like, can we declutter the UI so they can see it more easily? You know, things like that, where you make those little differences in people's lives to make their day 0.5% better. And people notice that and appreciate it, because that 0.5% gets replicated, you know, 8 to 12 hours a day, every day. And people really appreciate that. Yeah, you know, we had the same issue with touchscreens. All of our operators, all of our people work from iPads all day, every day. If that glove doesn't work with a touchscreen, they can't wear it, because the expectation of them operationally is that they're using an iPad all day. That was one of the things we overcame too. You know, we're paying more, a little bit more for gloves, but they're touchscreen compatible and they're thin enough to use every day. So it's been really beneficial for us to just listen to people and then try things out. I think that there is a hesitancy sometimes for safety people to just kind of experiment a little bit. We want to have these like meetings where we're gonna have a stand down and we're gonna talk about this change we're making, and we're gonna talk about how great this change is going to be. When it's a little easier, I think, to just kind of seed things out. It's like, hey, I've got this new thing. Can you try this out for me and just give me some feedback in a couple of days? You know, sometimes it doesn't work. I've gotten things back in a day and say this thing is garbage, and you just file it away and go, okay. Thanks. Yeah. You learned something from it, right?
You know,
yeah.
and that's the awesome thing, is that very rare, and to me, you hit the nail on the head. It's easy, especially safety professionals, companies, they get caught up in the same thing. And then the safety professionals, we're scared to try different things because we know the tried and true, we know our people. But, you know, especially thinking about what you work in, you're able to, because people are going out there, because it's constantly out and trying different things, the experimentation is, I think it's crucial. You know, we safety professionals, we talk all the time. It's, hey, what are you doing over there? Oh, I'm trying this and this, but then we don't always bring it back. So the fact of being able to test the waters, what really can make a positive impact? I think that's an underplayed and honestly even undervalued aspect that we don't incorporate the way we should.
Or feeling the need to ask permission to experiment.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of changes that I'm especially early on in my career, I was very afraid to do that. And then eventually kind of just let go of that. And at a previous role, we were during COVID, the safety committee kind of stopped meeting, you know, for obvious reasons. So when we brought it back, I brought it back just as a learning team and called it the safety committee, and just kind of didn't tell anybody that I was making the changes. Just kind of said, the safety committee's meeting again. I got a few people who were interested, but to be honest, we didn't review incidents. We didn't do a lot of the things that are traditionally safety committee activities, but we made huge, huge progressive changes to the equipment that we were working with at the time that, it, like, drastically improved the kind of day-to-day lives of the operators of that equipment. And then because of that, people started talking and I started getting suggestions freely given because of that. And a traditional safety committee never would have achieved that. You know, it would have been kind of probably an hour once a month where people kind of make some complaints, general complaints. We write them down, we'll record it into an Excel file and we'll say it came in this day, and then we're going to evaluate it. You know, up until this point, but, you know, instead we said, like, it was a multidisciplinary team the way I treated it was that basically if you were telling me you were going to do something, that you had been doing something unsafe, it was completely anonymous, but I always tried to make sure to give credit for the people's ideas, where it was like, we're going to change this operator position from X to Y, you know, for ergonomic reasons, or, you know, we're making changes here. And, you know, when you give people credit for their good ideas and give them a safe space to let them know all the bad things they're doing, it's amazing how that can work. But I kind of had to give up, giving up the need to do that traditional thing. And, you know, one of the advantages sometimes in safety is if you're a little bit off the radar, you can make those changes without necessarily seeking permission. Now, granted, like, that was kind of just a, there was a, one of the places that I worked, which has its own issues, had one of the ideas was that they would push out for everyone was like bias to action as opposed to discussion. And that was one of the things that I kind of took from that role. I was like, well, I'd rather ask forgiveness for doing something a little bit different. If it works really well and we get great feedback, people will probably go along with it. You know, we did the same thing with the observations program there. You know, it was a little bit punitive before, and then I changed it around, and you know, it was more about if behavior is an expression of a problem, how do we then go and dive into those issues and say, what's going on here? We're seeing this happening a lot. So something's happening here. There's something that we need to investigate more and understand, as opposed to just being someone kind of like we were talking to Julia, was like, put on the right gloves. You're not doing it right. And then recording it as we've corrected a behavior and that put 10 people at risk. And now there's, at us. We're being more safe now. And also emphasizing that normal work is overwhelmingly something that is done correctly and positive. So working with supervisors, like, all right, my expectation is that 80% of your observations are going to be positive, and thanking people for doing the things that they're doing, because they're doing it right almost all the time. And people get beat up at work for so many things. Can we not make safety one of them? It's amazing when you just say, hey, I saw you're doing this. Thanks for wearing the PPE there. I know sometimes it can be a pain. It's amazing when you like treat people as they are, intelligent, skilled people. The difference it makes, instead of treating them as like scolding a child for forgetting their safety glasses.
It's treating people the way you would want to be treated, isn't it? That's the thing with a lot of this, the sort of cultural piece, isn't it? And I'm not talking about safety culture. I'm talking about creating that good business culture. We talk about this all the time, but a lot of the time it's really simple things that you need to do. Or simple things that you need not to do if you're going to start to create that culture where people are going to really buy into stuff. And I suppose kind of leading on from that, Ryan, because I'm really interested, you talk about your workforce, and your workforce is really just non-present most of the time, isn't it? It's out there. It's out there in the wider world. Yeah. How do you get the message out to people? How do you sort of communicate really effectively with them to get those safety messages out there?
You know, when in looking at how to design a program like this, again, completely different for me, because I'm usually was at like a place. Everything that we do is mobile first, in the sense that it's really mobile only. Yeah, we don't have people interacting via computers. There you go. An iPad for us is a big interface, like physically large. You know, people are either using an iPhone or an iPad to interact with safety. So everything that we do has been pared down to the absolute barest necessity to accomplish what our goal is. So for our incident reports, we use QR codes like crazy, because in my opinion, at least, so say somebody's driving and they get into a car accident. I don't want them to have to think about, oh God, what was that training that I went to for? What do I do at this point? We have a label with a QR code, and they're like, I know that if I do this, I scan this, and now the information I need is going to be right there. You know, and so it's most of that kind of stuff is less than 5 clicks into anything. If it's more than 3, I start getting nervous, because I think that that's going to be too many layers for people to get to. And then for our incident reporting, went into it with just the idea that this can't take more than 30 seconds. If it takes more than 30 seconds, then we're going to start losing information. We're going to lose timeliness because they're going to go, I need to go, I'm going to go to an urgent care and then I'll do it. But so our incident reporting is, what happened, where did it happen, and how bad is it? Everything else we'll figure out after the fact. But it means that we've gotten significantly more reporting, or hazard reporting is the same way too. If somebody has a unique thing that they see out in the field that they think maybe people could learn from, that's been a kind of our big push for this year, is to try to get people more into that, where if you've got a creative solution to something you're seeing, let's make it really easy to say, hey, I was in this hoarder's basement and I did this, and take a picture. And I made my workplace a little safer. And now we have a platform for sharing that. And incident reporting is the same way. If you got a cut and it's first aid, great. We're not going to bog you down with a lot of investigative questions. If it warrants more discussion, we'll have that conversation later. But before, what would happen is we'd get incident reporting like 4 days after the fact. It was like, oh yeah, this happened, and I cut my hand. I went to urgent care, got stitches, and then I came back to work the next day. And now we've lost all of the information that we could have really used at that moment. So it literally, if you hustle, you can do it in less than 30 seconds and still get photos. And then the leadership team for that site and myself are notified immediately. It makes things very timely, and it makes it simple. And it's not mobile first in that sense of where we're just really compressing this long checklist and saying that, well, you can complete it on an iPhone. It's birthed from being in the mobile interface. There's nothing about it that you can't, I don't know if you even really can use. I mean, I've done incident reporting on the desktop, but it's a mobile interface on a desktop. It's not, it makes life a lot easier. It makes life easier for the people in the field. My life can be a little bit more complex because I'm sometimes getting weird information, but that just means I have to follow up with them. But if it's making their life easier, it makes me happy.
I think we always think about sort of keeping it stupidly simple for the kind of obvious reasons. I had a car crash at Christmas, and we're probably going back to the anthropology piece here, but it's the human reaction after that incident. And even just trying to take the guy's mobile number and get it into my phone was this massive task because my head was so shaken up by what had just actually happened to me that actually we've got to simplify it. And I think it's maybe one good thing that's come out of COVID is QR codes have just become synonymous with everyday life, haven't they? So everybody is happy to use a QR code. So it's a great thing for safety that we can make it really simple and easy for people to just bang into a QR code and then get the form filled out and filled out quickly. But yeah, it's that simplification is just key, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in our training's the same way. It's all delivered via mobile. I think 98% of our users take their training on an iPhone or an iPad. And I think that other 2% are a lot of our, some we have like, and again, showing the company's commitment to safety, like the site leaders will take the training as well. And really saying so they understand what's expected of their people and then can answer questions about any of that. So those 2% is generally people in leadership positions at a site level. But everything else is short videos, trying to make them as pertinent to their job as possible. So it tends to be HVAC specific or at least construction specific. We're doing a lot more with people recording our own videos. Just this last month, we were going through some HAZCOM training and just recording videos with some of our techs who have had, one of them had a great story about getting refrigerant burns in the field. And what happened and why it happened and kind of what he did afterwards. But to me, it's like that kind of, it's almost like peer-to-peer training, but it's all electronic, and giving it in small enough bites that people, well, first of all, we'll pay attention to the whole thing instead of sitting there within like a classroom training for an hour. But then also we'll remember that say you're going to use a hammer drill. And if you're not using a hammer drill, right, that thing will kick back and it you can get pretty seriously injured from it. But say you're that apprentice in the field and you're like, you know, I know I've got to do this. I'm going to be sawing through like 3 inches or, you know, drilling into 3 inches of like 3 feet of concrete here at a foundation. I'm going to go to our training platform and just search hammer drill and give people training, like that 2 minute video about like, hey, if you're using a hammer drill, watch out for X, Y, and Z. And now I know for myself, if I'm doing anything around the house or like on a car, I'm probably going to YouTube first just to see, like, hey, is there something I can get from this? So, you know, that kind of service delivery model of making ourselves kind of the YouTube of training is at least that's the guiding principle over it. It's not perfect. You know, there's sometimes I had to apologize to the teams this past week because one of our Hascom videos was really boring, but you know, it got the job done. And then we had, I think, things that were with it that were very compelling and interesting from their peers, essentially.
It's that doing it at the workplace, Ryan. It's that I'm a trainer and I've been a trainer for a long time, and I look back in horror at some of the things that we used to do where we used to, Langdon's rolling his eyes here, but it's where we would drag people into a classroom for 3 days and just bombard them with knowledge and actually then you stop and reflect on how much do they actually remember in the first place. But then when they get back to the workplace and maybe 2 months later, they think, oh, I know I got trained on that, but I kind of can't remember what on earth they said. So I think this evolution of training to at the point of work and really short and bite size and hopefully not too dull and too boring, yeah, is just, we just stand a chance that people take it on board and use it more effectively. Being able to put it immediately into practice is the biggie. That's the big change, I think. Yeah.
You know, even when we became very progressive and we started putting things on the computer, e-learning. We were like, yeah, e-learning, this is
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like sitting behind a computer for 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's...
We're punishing people who are doing return to work by making them do safety videos all day.
Yeah, yeah.
You got injured, now you've got to take a 4-hour course.
Right? Yeah. You know, I've been in positions where I've shown people those sign-in sheets, I've shown OSHA people that sign-in sheet and said, see, they have the knowledge now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just becomes like, looking back at it, like, God, that was such a farce. And and OSHA's like, great, thank you. Like, yep. And it just becomes like a compliance theater versus having something that like people can actually refer back to is small enough that they'll remember and care about. It's just, it cracks me up when I think about it. I'm so glad that people are starting to move away from that.
What OSHA should have said is, great, you've proved they can sign their name.
Right. or do the 5-question true or false answer sheet. That we held on to like it was like the original 10 commandments or something. It was just like, it was just ridiculous looking back at it. But,
well, you know, we appreciate, I think we're coming up on time, but we do appreciate, Ryan, the few minutes. And I think for me, and this was something I was really excited to every time I talk to you, and especially for the podcast, thinking about really the evolution, honestly, of work. I mean, that's kind of what this is. And when you get in the mobile aspect, and there's a lot of people that, you know, post COVID, they don't go to office anymore. When they do, it's hybrid. So for me, and thinking and being able to kind of discuss what some aspects you're doing differently, it's been fantastic. I really appreciate your time and just your thoughts into that realm.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Langdon did say you'll have no problem talking for an hour with this guy, and I think that's proved right.
But it's been
a great conversation. But I think the other thing is studying anthropology in a post-communist world is probably a great preparation for being a safety guy.
You just don't want to get me on like a safety culture sidetrack, because that's when I start going on a tear and it starts getting a little academic. I think it can be fun, but at the same time, my thing now, I'll just leave this, is I think culture is like a jar of jelly beans. people demonstrate it in certain, you know, different ways. And I think of your safety culture as jelly beans in a big jar, and it's going to all this, just all a bunch of different little points. And if you start treating people as those individual things, individual entities, as opposed to this big homogenous thing, you start really unlocking what the potential for safety can be. And you know, things like what we're doing are like that. It's trying to understand that people have very specific needs, and how can we meet that? And it's not all going to be the same. So, you know, like, let's try and at least make it easy for them to interact with us.
I love that. Great, yeah. Great point to finish on. Honestly, on Ryan. Yeah.
Totally agree. Yeah. he just dropped a mic right at the end. That was strong.
All right. I'm glad I can leave on something that's worthwhile.
No, but we do appreciate it. And everyone, we appreciate you joining. Look forward to the next podcast. But as we are continuing, as we leave this podcast, as we leave our days, we hope that everyone, that you can stay healthy, that you can stay safe, and ultimately, that you can watch each other's back out there. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Hey, everyone. Really appreciate you tuning into this episode of Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. Please follow and subscribe to wherever you stream your favorite podcast, or visit us at evotix.com.
And if you want to see how follically challenged we really are, come and check us out on YouTube. If you've got value from the podcast, please go to Apple Podcasts. And in the review section of this podcast, if you could leave us a review or a rating, that would be great.
And as always, everyone, while you're going about your days, about your normal lives, stay safe out there and watch each other's back.